Test 1, 2, 3. Hey, B, is that you, Bo? Welcome. Welcome. The chimes. Tonight's show, Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show, to be exact. Excuse me, we are live in New York with Steve Barish. Of course, he won't be on tonight. This is not a call-in show. This is a regular show. Next week, we have Michio Kaku on. He's also in New York right now. He's out there in California. We kind of swapped ends of the countryside. And he's out in California at Caltech giving a lecture. That's tomorrow night. You get out to Caltech, go see Mr. Kaku. He's amazing. Tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to be talking about part of my book, actually, and this is a part of it where we're talking about the CIA and the different projects that took place during the 50s and 60s, and actually they're ongoing. They're still taking place. They're just classified. This is some of the declassified stuff that we're talking about. MK Ultra was the one that one of the bigger programs that everybody's somewhat heard of. And MKUltra took place over a number of years, and it had basically 149 sub-programs in it, and they were all different ones. 149. Most of them were done by civilian organizations under grants. The average grant would run anywhere between $2,000 or $3,000 and $1 million or $2, depending on who they were destroying, I would say, in these different experiments. So anyway, we'll talk a little bit about this, and I'm going to have a lot of this information, of course, in the inside track. But it's always nice to share this with you, the information that I've got now. And of course, it started off with the end of World War II. I think Hitler is the one that really launched these programs. And Operation Paperclip, of course, brought a lot of the programmees over to the United States. One of the German secret programs was called Paperclip Project 63. And through these different programs, over 1,000 German scientists and their families were secretly brought into the United States without the State Department scrutiny or approval. And recruitment of German scientists through Paperclip and related projects continued into the 1980s. Of course, Wernher von Braun is the guy that you all know that I worked for. When we worked in the Apollo program, and before that, the Saturn program. We built the capsules, and then we built the bottom end to get the thing up there. And Von Braun had about 20,000 inmates at Camp Dora, and this is all up. This was underground, most of it, and it was in the Mittelwerk area of northern Germany. And the sad part of it about it is that these workers working on these V-2 missiles were given a piece of bread and margarine a day until they pretty much starved to death. And a lot of the people, the workers, were aware of what they were building, and so they would try to sabotage the V-2. They would urinate on the parts to make them contaminated. They would cut wires. Of course, if they got caught, they were immediately hanged. So it wasn't the best thing in the world to do, you know, to do that for them. And at the Nuremberg trials, von Braun was said by a Nazi defendant to have worked closely with a Dr. Albin Sawatzky. And Camp Dora prisoners identified Sawatzky as being in charge of much of the deadly treatment they received and personally administered beatings. And I remember You know, von Braun personally was a high level. He was a member of the elite SS. As a matter of fact, he was a full-blown colonel in the SS. But he was pardoned. You know, in the end, he defected, as you all know, and got his arm broken climbing over a fence, and all kinds of things happened to him. But he was definitely knowledgeable of the mistreatment of the way they treated people at Camp Dora. Medical doctors also came over. Dr. Albertus Strughold was the chief scientist of the Aerospace Medical Division of the U.S. Air Force in 1961. And he is regarded as the father of aviation medicine. And his first job in the U.S. was to head the Air Force School of Aviation Medicine at Randolph Field, Texas. And then later on in 1949, he took charge of the newly department-created Department of Space Medicine. So this gives you an idea of the beginning of the space program. Then, of course, they used a lot of these prisoners at different places. Like, for example, Dr. Strughold, being one of the people that was brought over, was the head of the Luftwaffe Institute of Aviation Medicine in Berlin during the war. At the Nuremberger trials, his military superiors, close associates, and one of his subordinates were all tried for war crimes, although Strughold was never arrested, interrogated, or called as a witness. And there's a Nuremberg investigator, Herbert Meyer, was given firsthand information about Strughold's direct involvement in war crimes for which people close to him were tried. Hermann Becker Freising, who gave this information to Meyer, was found guilty at Nuremberg and sentenced to 20 years in prison. One of the studies, just to give you an idea how cruel this was, one of the studies by the Nazi aviation doctors involved an attempt to ascertain the effects of ejecting from an airplane at high altitudes. Concentration camp prisoners were placed in a special chamber, and the pressure would be dropped to the equivalent of 39,260 feet. And of course, you can imagine, many subjects went insane, and some of them died. And I remember Dachau very well because I was in it when I was in my last life, but I remember in this life cutting my arms trying to get in the place because I got there and it was closed. That was back about 1988, and I went to Dachau, north of Munich. I was living in Munich. I just moved there, and I had a second house there, and I remember cutting my arms on the fences trying to climb in the place to see what it looked like because I hadn't seen it since a past life. But anyhow, there Himmler, you know, Himmler, Heinrich Himmler, the chicken farmer, he approved the use of about 200 prisoners, Russians, Jews, and members of the Polish resistance, in experiments by Dr. Sigmund Rascher. The experiments were expected to be fatal. Rascher went one step beyond prior research and instantly decompressed objects to the equivalent of 69,000 feet, which caused people to pull out hair, tear their faces with their fingernails, and pound their heads on the wall. Nearly 80 men died from being kept at a simulated high altitude for up for 30 minutes. Others were taken out of the chambers alive, held underwater till they drowned, and autopsy determined the amount of air embolism in their brains. The reactions of the men inside the chambers were oftentimes they were filmed. So this gives you a... there was a guy named Karl Hohenreiner, who was a gypsy prison camp inmate who survived experiments at Dachau. Conducted by Wilhelm Briegelbach. Hohenheimer was in Auschwitz for a while, and then his child and his sister and her two children were killed. He was then transported there to Buchenwald, where he was rerouted to Dachau. There he and other subjects were starved when forced to drink putrid seawater or seawater treated by one of two purification methods. Those who refused to be, were tied up and force-fed by tubes. That was just the beginning of what Hitler was all about and what they were doing. On top of that, Dachau was also the state of mind control experiments with the drug mescaline. Nazi doctors, including Dr. Kurt Plotner, administered mescaline to unwitting subjects by spiking the prisoners' drinks. During the same period, similar experience involving mescaline, marijuana, barbiturates, and scopolamine, if I can say it right, were conducted by Dr. Winfried Offenhauser at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. So this was the transference, this was the transference of the Nazi stuff, the war crime stuff, over to the U.S. government. So this gives you an idea. Theodore Wagner Jagereg worked at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Germany before the war, and then he worked at the Edgware Arsenal from 1948 to 55 before returning to Europe. The Edgware Arsenal was one of the key centers for the CIA and the Army LSD mind control research during the 50s and 60s. In a paper of defensive chemical weapon, an antidote to a class of drug called acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, the authors say in a footnote that the experiments results in this paper were obtained several years ago, but its publication has been delayed for various reasons. Well, of course, we talked about this before, and that was the Tuskegee syphilis study. Now, this is what we were doing simultaneous before the war. We were doing this back in 1933. And the Tuskegee syphilis study was clearly unethical and harmful to its subjects. And it violated the 1943 Henderson Act, an Alabama public health statute for mandatory reporting of tuberculosis and venereal disease. And the state health laws passed in 1927, 1957, and 1969. The study was conducted at Macon County, Alabama, in 1932 as a spinoff from a 1930 project funded by what's called a Rosewald Fund with a grant of $50,000. That's like $5 million today, of course. The study was run by the Public Health Service, which also co-funded mind control research during World War II. During its 40 numerous years, accounts of the study were published in medical journals, including a 1964 paper in the Archives of Internal Medicine entitled The Tuskegee Study of the Untreated Syphilis, 30 Years of Observation. And the paper sort of starts out like, the year 1963 marks the 30th year of the long-term evaluation of the effect of untreated syphilis in the male Negro conducted by the Venereal Disease Bunch, Communicable Disease Center, United States Public Health Service. And it summarizes the whole thing. And the surgeon and the people and organizations that knew about the study included the Surgeon General, the American Heart Association, the Macon County Medical Society, the Public Health Service, and the Center for Disease Control. So when you see Center for Disease Control methods, it's very much connected to the CIA. And what they did is they in 1932, 399 illiterate, poor, rural black men with syphilis were recruited as subjects, along with 201 controls without syphilis. The purpose of the study was to make sure the 399 men never got treatment. The follow-ups were decades to see how the syphilis affected them. Part of the study was to compare the results of a similar study done in Norway by Dr. Trygve Gustland, who visited the Tuskegee study in November 1951. That's always been a tongue twister for me. And what happened was, after these studies, the ones that they were all given $25 in cash. That's all the money they were given. And then when Senator Ted Kennedy became aware of it, and there was a Congress released a study of this, a lawsuit ensued. And after the lawsuit was over with, the media attention that came to this thing, this is about 1972 or so, actually started first in 69 and 72, the public exposure of this horrible thing. So on July 23rd, 1973, attorney Fred Gregg filed a $1.8 billion class action suit in the United States District Court for the Middle District of Alabama. And the defendants in the lawsuit were the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, the U.S. Health Service, and the Center for Disease Control, the State of Alabama, the State Board of Health for Alabama, and the Milbank Fund. And, of course, in December of 1974, about a year later, the government agreed to an out-of-court settlement for $10 million. So the cash payments were made as follows: $37,500 for every living subject, which is kind of sad, $15,000 each to the heirs of the deceased subjects, $16,000 to living control subjects, and $5,000 to the heirs of deceased controls. In May 1997, President Clinton issued an official apology for the Tuskegee subject to their families. So that just gives you an idea
how silly this stuff was when they were doing all these things.
So anyway, continuing on here, okay. The role of the basic general of medicine, you know, the lesson is that in the Tuskegee study is the same as the psychiatry's role in mind control. Now, later on, unethical radiation experiments were conducted on about 600 subjects in the United States beginning in the 1940s and running into the 1970s. And these experiments overlap the chemical and biological weapons research and mind control experimentation. The radiation experiments were funded by a variety of government agencies, including the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, and the CIA. Subjects did not give meaningful informed consent. Of course, President Clinton then set up a committee to look into radiation in 1993. The information had been made public in a Senate subcommittee report produced by Representative Edward Markey of Massachusetts in 1986, but didn't generate any public reaction at the time. An example of unethical radiation research is an experiment done on Eb Cade, a 53-year-old black man who was in a car accident on March 24, 1945. He was in treatment for fractures and injuries at Oak Ridge Army Hospital when he was injected with 4.7 milligrams of plutonium on April 10th, 5 days before his fractures were set. The experimental protocol was to sample his blood for 4 hours after injection, bone tissue 96 hours after, and body excretions for 40 to 60 days, all to measure the plutonium levels. Bone samples were taken and his fractures were set, and some of his teeth were extracted for analysis. Many people were injected with plutonium X-ray and exposed to other forms of radiation without their informed consent. Elmer Allen and his wife, Frida, another African-American couple, were pleased when in 1973 doctors offered them a free trip to New York to study why he had survived bone cancer so long. As part of the trip, they were picked up by a limousine in Chicago, and Mr. Allen was taken to the Argonne National Laboratory while his wife went sightseeing. So that directors at the University of California in San Francisco injected Mr. Allen with plutonium. Yeah, that's nice. July 14, 1947. 4 days before his leg was amputated for bone cancer. Mr. Allen and 17 other patients were injected with plutonium in an experiment run by the Manhattan Project. So you know the Manhattan Project, that's where we made the first atomic bomb. Then there were prisoners in Washington and Oregon. State prisons were paid to have their testicles irradiated. They got $5 a month for the irradiation, $10 each time a testicle was biopsied, and $100 for completing the experiment. And of course, in jail, I guess that's tempting, but that was another experiment. In one experiment, now this is where it gets a little bit sad. I remember this one. In one experiment, codenamed Green Run, radioactive iodine was released from the Hanford nuclear facility and drifted over Spokane. The cloud contained hundreds and perhaps thousands of times as much radiation as released accidentally at Three Mile Island in 79. So the people up in Washington, they've had some experiments laid on them, and even today it's a high radiation zone. This gives you an idea how this all started and where it began and what MKUltra was all about. Now, I know a lot of you know that I was involved with MKUltra, but I didn't, first of all, know what it was at the time. And secondly, I wasn't a victim of an experiment. I worked with Stephen Eberbaugh at the University of Michigan And what we had done is we had developed a series of electrodes that be connected, glass of water here, non-surgically to the head. In other words, they were just a clamp-on things that we made. We then hooked it up to different wave generators, square wave, sine wave, and we then experimented putting frequencies into our own brains. So we were self-experimenting here. And then we had an oscilloscope to monitor, connected to some other electrodes, to see what the shift in phase and wavelength and all that would be between where the injection, where we injected the electricity into our brains, and what and where it passed through our head and came out in another part of that brain area, the head area. And that's what we were doing. And then we were introducing self-hypnosis and also hypnotizing each other as best we could. I don't hypnotize too well, unfortunately or fortunately. Don't hypnotize at all, but I'm very good at hypnotizing others. And so we were doing this at home, and then we were working at the University of Michigan. And so it fell under one of the sub-projects over there of MKUltra. And studies were made from our work, and that was my participation. We had no idea that there were prisoners being tested, and people were having electrodes actually sewn into their heads and all the other stuff that went on later on. We had no clue that was going on, and we were just kids. Maybe that's why something's wrong with me now. Radiation experiments were interwoven with research on chemical and biological systems, weapons rather, infectious diseases. Dr. Saul Krugman of New York University and his staff deliberately injected several mentally retarded children at Willowbrook State School with hepatitis virus in the 1950s and 60s. And if you remember correctly, I mentioned it before, in 1960, they injected 1 million people in Mobile, Alabama, who thought they were getting polio vaccines with a cancer virus. They actually injected the cancer. Clinton had to apologize for that one, too. Dr. Krugman, whose research was funded by the Army Medical Research and Development Command, Department of the Army, and that was under contract DA Dog Apple 49-193 MD, like medical doctor, -2331. It was also sponsored by the Commission of Viral Infections, the Armed Forces Epidemiological Board, Office of the Surgeon General, and additionally it was reviewed and approved by the New York University School of Medicine in Committee on Human Experimentation in the New York State Department of Mental Hygiene. The ethics of Krugman's 1971 research were debated in a magazine called The Lancet. Now, Krugman, he defended the morality of the project and said it was scientifically justified, although to date there has been no compensation for the victims of unethical biological experiments, and the federal government has officially disagreed with the apologies from the radiation experiments. Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary announced in New York on November 19, 1996, that 12 families of victims of radiation were being compensated for a total of $4.8 million. And that was reported in the Dallas Morning News, November 20, 1996, page 6A. The only victim still alive to receive compensation directly was Mary Jean Connell, a 74-year-old woman in Avon, New York. So a little bit more information there for you. And eventually what these projects are, where they were leading to, it became known as our Operation Stargate. But the bottom line was they were looking for the Manchurian candidate. That's what they were looking for. These experiments began during World War II and had at least some elements of the program, such as non-lethal weapons, have continued to the present. Now, today they're classified, just so you know, so we don't get that much information. Paranormal experiments under Stargate continued until 1984, and the Army doctors were actively involved in LSD testing until the late 1970s, if you can believe that. That's pretty late, you know, for LSD. Another thing that happened is the responsibility for unethical experimentation lies first with the individual doctors, but also collectively with the medical profession as a whole and the academia as a whole. The Department of Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University, for example, may experience blowback resulting from decades of collusion, secrecy, and direct participation in mind control experimentation. So what is blowback?
Well,
okay. Blowback is a CIA term, by the way. It's a CIA term it's called for negative publicity, and they sure get a lot of it these days. That's for sure. You know, negative publicity for a lot of things, and so it's a term for negative publicity resulting from clandestine operations. Somewhere in this network of doctors and medical schools, there is a yet unidentified creators of the Manchurian candidates. Now, Bloomberg was the first, one of the early projects. It was approved by Roscoe Hillencoder, director of the CIA, on April 20, 1950. And then in 1951, the project was renamed Artichoke. And the Korean War began in June of 1950. The CIA already had a mind control programs in operation prior to the Korean War. Therefore, such programs were not a defensive reaction to the activities of North Koreans, Russians, or communists, Chinese, or whatever during the Korean War, as claimed by the CIA career officer Edward Hunter. Bluebird and Artichoke included a great deal of work on the creation of amnesia, hypnotic couriers, and the Manchurian candidate. Okay, now, a lot of times, the Manchurian candidate is generally regarded as fiction. However, Artichoke documents prove that hypnotic couriers functioned effectively in real-life simulations conducted by the CIA in 1950s. The degree in which with such individuals were in actual operations is still classified. Physicians were an integral part of the Artichoke team and conducted interrogations on U.S. soil. These interrogations were in part designed to detect mind control agents of other agencies and governments. The document documents established that Manchurian candidate-related methods were part of a CIA counterintelligence work in the late 1950s. The basic premise now of the book, The Manchurian Candidate, which we see a lot of movies made from, is that a group of American POWs in the Korean War is brainwashed while crossing through Manchuria to freedom. They arrive back in the U.S. They're amnesic for a period of brainwashing, and then one of them has been programmed to be an assassin. His target is the candidate for the president of the United States. His handlers at home control him with a hypnotically implanted trigger and a particular playing card. And that's the sci-fi side of it, but that's how it's actually done. But a lot of post-hypnotic suggestions, a lot of electrical shock therapy, and a lot of drugs. And so they develop, as high as 14 personalities, as far as I think that's pretty much the number. So therefore, the Manchurian candidate can be a spy, go to Russia, pretend to be a Russian spy, come back here, unload information, or if they're in Russia and they get caught, they can be interrogated. But when the interrogation process starts, they have a different personality, so that they don't even know they work for the CIA, because the interrogation process has triggered another personality. So they would pass the lie detector test and whatever. And then when the interrogation period is over, they may not even remember it. I mean, that's what this stuff is all about. So, according to two definitions, and this is the definition of a doctor that was on my show about 3 weeks ago, Colin A. Ross, who I hope to have on again. He defines the Manchurian candidate as an experimentally created dissociative identity disorder that meets the following four criteria. One, created deliberately. Two, a new identity is implanted. Three, amnesia barriers are created. Four, used in simulated or actual operations. Bluebird and Artichoke were administered in a compartmentalized fashion.
The details of the programs were kept secret even from other personnel within the CIA. When asked why LSD research done on Artichoke was hidden from the CIA committee in charge of Artichoke, Sidney Gottlieb, human drug testing by the CIA, page 410, chief medical staff, technical services division of the CIA responded, "I imagine the only reason would have been concern for broadening awareness of its existence." In other words, they didn't want anybody to know about it. Okay? Not at all. Loss of central control occurred in CIA's Operation Chaos, and probably in Bluebird, Artichoke, and Operation Chaos was a CIA program was designed to collect information on foreign influence on student and civil unrest in the United States. This is back when the FBI and Herbert Hoover were sniffing all over the place. Chaos developed files on 7,200 American citizens, and files included mention of a total of 300,000 named U.S. citizens and organizations. And that's back in 1974, when we only had about 30 million people. So you had 1 out of 10 people, or 1 out of 100 people, was on a file somewhere, and I'm sure they're still there now. This was all entered into a computerized index. This is under the Nelson Rockefeller report to the president by the Commission of CIA Activities in 1975. Chaos intelligence generated 3,500 internal CIA memorandas, 3,000 memorandas for the FBI, 37 for the distribution to the White House and other top levels of government. The maximum Chaos staff was 52 people in 1971. So anyway, this is the beginning of course, then, the next thing, which is real interesting, is that first of all, in other instances, senior administrators within the CIA participated in a plausible denial and other disinformation. Now, we know all about that disinformation. We talk about that a lot. And cover-up strategies concerning CIA operations run on U.S. soil. And I've got right here about 150 programs that were ran on U.S. soil, and every one of them listed. I probably won't get to all of them today, but I'll name some of them. In 1952, the CIA began to survey mail between the U.S. and Soviet Union at a New York postal facility. In 1953, it began to open and read mail. The program was approved by the director of the CIA and at least three postmasters, Generals Summerfield, Day, and Blount, as well as by the Attorney General Mitchell. From 1958 to 1973, the FBI received 57,000 pieces of mail from the CIA in this program. In the final year of the operation, 4,350,000 pieces of mail between the U.S. and Soviet Union. The CIA examined the outside of 2,300 pieces, photographed 33,000, and opened 8,700. So that gives you some... this happened in different. There were smaller intercept operations. I remember very recently, as of a couple of years ago, mail between California and Arizona was getting opened on a pretty regular basis. Nobody, of course, knew why something was going on. So anyway, the Artichoke interrogation was conducted in a safe house in a remote countryside, staffed by security-cleared people. Personnel. See, they don't just, you know, they have these little remote areas that they go to and these little buildings, and they might just rent a house next door to you and conduct an experiment, and you just think some strange family lives there. That's how it goes. It was conducted under medical cover of a routine physical and psychological assessment. The subject was transported to the safe house in a covert car, which picked him up at a secure location. At the safe house, he was given a conventional interrogation and then some whiskey. Well, that's great. This was followed up by 2 grams of phenobarbital, which put him to sleep. The next day, a lie detector test was given. The subject was given intravenous chemicals. Following the chemical-assisted interrogation, according to the CIA terminology, the artichoke techniques were applied in 3 stages. 1. A false memory was introduced into the subject's mind without his conscious control of the process, which took 15 to 20 minutes. The procedure was repeated this time, taking 40 to 45 minutes later. The procedure was repeated again and again, and air interrogation added. So they just kept putting in suggestions, and on and on and on. CIA career officer Edward Hunter, as I mentioned earlier, by the way, described the implantation of false memories by Chinese intelligence agencies in his book Brainwashing in Red China. And then page 11, he wrote that the Chinese masses were right in coining the phrases brainwashing and brain changing. There is a difference between the two. Brainwashing is an indoctrination or a comparatively simple procedure, but brain changing is an immense more sinister and complicated. Whereas you merely have to undergo a brain cleansing to rid yourself of imperialist poisons, in order to have a brain changing, you must empty your mind of old ideas and recollections. In a brain changing, a person's specific recollections of some other period, past period in his life, are wiped away as completely as if they never happened. Then, to fill these gaps in memory, the ideas which authorities want this person to remember are put into his brain. Hypnotism and drugs are cunning pressures that plague the body and do not necessarily require marked physical violence. Are required for brain changing. China evidently was not so advanced as yet. China was using brainwashing, and when that didn't work, resorting to a simpler purge system. But in time, China will use the brain changing system too. I'm sure they are by now, very much so. It's amazing. Just to give you a little bit of one of the interrogations. Okay, now here's one of the worst ones that I've ever seen. To me, this is what movies are made out of. Okay, and trying to find the section on this thing. I just had it a minute ago. Okay, this is what happened during the Cold War, and this is an interrogation involving artichoke techniques and physicians. It was conducted on a Russian defector, Yuri Nosenko. I don't know if you remember Yuri Nosenko. He made the news, and he was under James Angleton's administrations. Angleton suspected Nosenko of being a triple agent. A triple agent, by the way, is someone who pretends to be a defector or a double agent, but is actually working for his original native country. Triple agents. He was born in Nikolaev, Ukraine, in 1927. He was trained by the Russian Naval Intelligence before transferring to MVD, that was a precursor of the KGB, in 1953. On June 5th of 1962, Nosenko made a secret contact with a U.S. State Department official in Geneva. A meeting resulted in his being recruited by the CIA as a mole. Nosenko provided a rich fund of intelligence information to the CIA until he defected February 1964. And remember how that works. When you're a double agent, you feed the other side just enough information that's truthful, and then you feed them a bunch of disinformation. This went on back and forth. That was why it was so important to have our satellite programs in the U-2 flying at these times, because they didn't know what was going on in Russia. They wanted to know what their weapons were all about. That was the main thing. Anyhow, Angleton thought that Nosenko had been feeding the CIA a little bit of real information in order to cover up the fact he was a triple agent. In late 1964, a decision was made to apply artichoke-like techniques to him. Now, you talk about violations of the Geneva Conference. Wait till I describe an artichoke technique. It's not going to be very pleasant, all right? So get ready for this one. Okay? And some of this stuff is still classified, by the way. Nosenko was strip-searched, given a lie detector test, and then placed in solitary confinement in a 10-foot by 10-foot cell in a safe house in Washington for 16 months. Now, you talk about waterboarding. This makes waterboarding look like surfing, okay? One of his interrogators was Dr. John Gittinger, the lead psychologist for MKUltra, who described taking LSD himself in a documentary film. From April 4th to 1964 to August 13, 1965, that's about a year, okay, or a little under a year, not much, Nosenko was now held in a safe house and subjected to repeated interrogations. From August 14th, 1965 to October 28th, 1967, hello, that's a long time, Nosenko was held in a solitary confinement in a tiny, windowless concrete cell at the CIA's training camp at Camp Perry, Virginia. That's two more years now. He was subjected to sleep and food deprivation, and there was neither heat nor air nor air conditioning in his cell.
He was monitored by a closed-circuit television 24 hours a day. In an interview with Tom Mangold on June 12, 1990, John Gittinger described being asked by the CIA personnel to administer LSD to Nisenko. Gittinger claimed he did not do so. Nisenko, however, described being drugged on a number of occasions at Camp Perry. Due to administrative changes inside the CIA, Nisenko was released from confinement in 1967 and later became a U.S. citizen. Now, I don't know if I'd want to be a U.S. citizen after going through all that. Maybe they programmed to be a U.S. citizen. That's just a little bit too scary for me, anyway. So, whoever the Nisenko interrogators were and whatever cryptonym they worked under, it is clear that physicians and mind control specialists were directly involved. It is also clear the actions of these physicians was unethical and inhumane. The Bluebird and Artichoke documents prove that Nisenko interrogation was not an isolated incident. Such an interrogation was conducted by physicians in a third world country. It would be decried as human rights violations, political abuse of psychiatry. We have been lax as a medical profession in applying these standards at home. It's very true. So it just gives you an idea of one little incident. And the deconditioning, it's just amazing what's been going on. People, hypnosis is another thing. It was not the mind. Hypnosis was not the mind control's only method for creation of controlled amnesia. Now I'm talking about that. Drugs, magnetic fields, sound waves, sleep deprivation, solitary confinement, and many other methods were studied under Bluebird and Artichoke. Amnesia was often tested through memorization tasks of various kinds and experiments conducted to amplify subjects' memories for hidden information hidden behind amnesia barriers. As well as being potential barriers and infiltration agents, the subjects could function in effect as hypnotically controlled cameras. They would enter a room, a building, and memorize materials quickly, leave the building, and be amnesic for the entire episode. The memorized material could then be retrieved by a handler using a previously implanted code or signal without the amnesia being disturbed. The research and its applications were both offensive and defensive, as evidenced by the following an untitled message from one of the documents. For instance, metrazole, which is a very useful therapy, is no longer popular because of one thing. It produces feelings of overwhelming terror and doom prior to convulsion. But terror, anxiety, and worry would be valuable for many purposes from our point of view. We have some information, not in detail and not confirmed, that the Soviets and their satellites have used drugs which work well along these lines. Therefore, this should be studied in both for our use offensively and defensively and find antidotes for counteracting agents. Quite often amnesia occurs for events just prior to the convulsion, during the convulsion and during the post-seizure state. It is possible that hypnosis or hypnotic activity induced during the post-seizure state might be lost in amnesia. This would be very valuable. So this is just some of the stuff that goes into the complexity of the Manchurian Candidate experiments. People don't realize that this today it's much more sophisticated. They can actually, you go into a room, you can pass on information. They've used prostitutes to do this. There was a Kathy O'Brien story that a lot of people didn't believe. It's very true. It's out there. Who is a government prostitute, but at the same time she transmitted information and she went to foreign countries and got in with these foreign dignitaries and pretty much read their program and then brought the program back, and then of course she didn't even remember doing it. And it was finally many years later, after she did all this clandestine stuff, that she remembered that all these things happened, because her boyfriend at the time was able to unprogram her, deprogram her from the amnesia they created during the Manchurian Candidate process. I'm going to show you a few of these funding. This is MK Ultra contracts, and this is just a few of them. And a lot of these people are still around if you want to talk to them. This was subpod project number one, Princeton University, 1953, $2,000, which should be like $20,000 a day, a study of Reveria crumbosa. Number two, James Hamilton, contractor, status, top secret, Stanford University, 1953, $4,650. Possible synergistic action of drugs which may be appropriate for use in abolishing consciousness. Contractor, subcontract number three, George White, top secret, Bureau of Narcotics, 1953, $8,875. Construction of a safe house for prostitution. And I just mentioned prostitution. Remember Kathy O'Brien? There you go. That was a subcontract three experiment on MKUltra. Number four, contractor John Mulholland, self-employed, 1953. This is an individual. He got $4,132.27. Delivery of substances in field operations, like black heroin, like supposedly somebody in their executive department used to like black heroin, and somebody named Kathy O'Brien would bring it to him. Alden Sears, top secret. This is subproject number five. University of Denver, Minnesota, 1956, $12,139.65. hypnosis experiments including recall of hypnotically acquired information by very specific signals. And those we used to call that, It was post-hypnotic suggestion. I'm going to skip down a few of them now. Subcontract number six, top secret, institution E.I. Lilly. Now these, 1953, $5,000 to develop a reliable source of U.S. source of LSD. What happened was, and the reason this was done, the Russians bought all the LSD. Alfred Hoffman discovered, was working with ergot on the rye mold, ergot fungus on the rye mold in 1947. He discovered LSD. And it was about a few years later when the CIA started working with it in these experiments, as we're reading now, the Russians bought $30 million worth of LSD from Hoffman, from his lab over there, Searle. As a result, the CIA couldn't get any, so they had to make their own. That's what I was telling you about. Harold Abramson, his name came up a lot, Office of Naval Research Public Service. He got, in 1953, he got $90,448.29, topic LSD. And I've got some of the declassified documents. I don't think I'm going to reprint them, but I will tell you where you can find them very soon. I'll send you to let everybody do your own research. Carl Pfeiffer, subcontract number nine, top secret, Emory University of Illinois. See, they're all public-private companies. He got $20,889 for various sternutatory agents of normal schizophrenic human beings. Sternutatory agents on normal. So he was trying to make people even more schizoid. Another one is George White. Subcontract 14, top secret, institution, Bureau of Narcotics, 53, $3,500, construction of a safe house for prostitution. These are government contracts to make whorehouses. And then there was a continuation of that one on subcontract 15, which was a continuation of subproject 4. That was for delivery of substances to field operations. Harold Hodge, University of Denver, Minnesota, 1953, LSD metabolism, $29,172. E.I. Lilly got $400,053 for to manufacture LSD. I mean, that's where we got our own source. We were having to get it from over in Switzerland until we could finally get it here. These are subcontracts. Every one is all part of MKUltra. I'm being a lot more specific than we have been. There's another one down here, subcontract 25, Alden Sears, top secret, University of Minnesota. Hypnotic technique. $12,360.85. They used to have quite a bookkeeping system. That's why I can get right down to the penny for this stuff, you know. And I haven't even gotten into the forcing of children against their will to do all kinds of things. It's experiments run on kids. We haven't got to that point yet. Then there we get. I'm going down some of these. I'm just going to list a few of these interests. I haven't got into the implants yet. Carl Pfeiffer in a subcontract number 28 in the MKUltra, Emory University, 1954, top secret. He got $24,996.40 for the effects of central nervous system depressant drugs in animals and man. And you don't even want to know. I've seen some of these experiments when I was in Letterman Hospital for a little while in the U.S. Army and working over there. And I saw some stuff. I used to see a lot of this electroshock therapy, and people were just freaking out over that stuff. They did a lot of electroshock. It was big thing that was part of the program is they strap you down. They basically electrocute you as many times as they can to brainwash you. It's just amazing. Then they got into implanting animals, and you know, like to make animals, to control animals and cats and all kinds of things. Here's one on subproject 50, Camp Dietrich, 1955, $500, petty cash fund related to subprojects 13 and 30. And 30 was purchasing materials and unusual activities. And plug again, I think. This plug's been pretty good today, so we don't get the static. We're trying to fix that, you know. We've had a real problem with it. And I'm going to go up into the higher subprojects. Stop it. There. I've got a wire down here that just wants to give problems. Trying to think of some of the other experiments here. Here's one, number 122, unwitting status, 1960, $2,000. Brain studies in cats, neurokinin research. Brain studies in cats. You don't want to, probably, they oftentimes dissect the cat after they play. Another one here, number 113. These are all subprojects of MKUltra, I'm reading. 1960, $3,000. Gas propelled sprays and aerosols. And number 112, contract is Melvin DeFleur, unwitting. University of Indiana, 1961, $6,056.66. Young children's understanding of occupational roads. The one before that, 110. The contractor's not listed because it's still classified. Bacterial and Pharmacological Consultants, Inc. That was the institution. 210,000 exotic pathogens. Now, haven't I not mentioned the fact that I've mentioned many times that these viruses that are out there, that these horrible seasonal viruses that we get, are man-made, a lot of them. And this man-making of these things started previous. It started previous to to the present time. It started quite a while ago. And here's, now to give you an example specifically, subcontract 139, Pennsylvania State University, clearance level not specified, year 1961, $55,670. Viral infections and avian vectors. Aha. Now what was this? Last one we had the big scare, bird flu, the avian virus? Well, because that was one of the subcontracts from the CIA on human beings. Here's another one, a top secret, number 146, 1963, all classified, $7,500, anti-crop systems, including sugar crops. In other words, poisoning people through sugar. And then the last one, which is the last one that is a public record, is 149, George White, top secret, Bureau of Narcotics, of course, $10,000, realistic tests of certain development items and delivery systems. So we'll continue on with this. There's a lot more. We have a lot more information for you. This is just a beginning of what I'm explaining in my book, Inside Track, of what goes on and what's gone on and what I've seen. And it gets a lot worse, but it also gets a lot better because 33 years ago when we started Paradigm, we knew this stuff was going to happen, and it had been happening because I'd seen it before. But now, because of declassification of all these documents, I'm able to absolutely... I used to just talk in generalities because I was limited for a while by my own secret clearance. Now, this is released documents, and if anybody emails me, I can turn you on to fredbelletparadigm.com, or just wait for my book. I'll turn you on to some declassified documents to back up every word that I said today. So that's been Friday night with Dr. Fred Bell, the Health Science and Energy Show. Next Friday night, we're going to have Michio Kaku on. Tomorrow night, we'll have our show like we do, and it'll be a canned show. So until then, have a good night. Sleep well after this one.